Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I welcome the online audience and our video audience and our audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And I would like to introduce you to Philip Howard. I'll give you good background on Philip because he's, as I said, an unusual project for a lawyer. He's a graduate of the University of Virginia. He practices law in New York at Covington Burling. That said, he stands apart from the greater legal community. Many consider him a maverick. For the past 10 years as a devoted civic leader, Philip has passionately dedicated his career to reforming the burdensome, dysfunctional bureaucracy that he feels has stifled the American brand of democracy. Philip serves as chair of Common Good, the nonprofit organization that he founded in 2002. With the assistance of a small staff of New York and Washington, Philip spearheads the effort to unite the political left and right to facilitate a systematic overhaul of the federal and state bureaucracies. Talk about a project. Sorry for the interruption, but uniting the political left and the right, you should be president. And that for 4 years, here come the presidents. So President Obama and Mitt Romney have signed on to important segments of the Common Good's mission, where consensus is that too much law has stifled Americans' capacities to make sound and informed choices for themselves. In Philip's words, our mature democracy is so encrusted with accumulated laws and mandates that it no longer has the capacity to make the sound and informed choices needed to meet the challenges of the times. Common Good's current campaign, Start Over, seeks to sustain the mission of Common Good and has developed focused, attainable goals, which Philip will discuss. Philip has recently appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and is currently partnering with The Atlantic with a remarkable online discussion series, America the Fixable, that has attracted contributors from many disciplines and points of view, including Jeb Bush, Mitch Daniels, Mark Warner, among others. His talk at the recent TED conference, Technology, Education, and Design, brought the audience to its feet and was dubbed brilliant by CNN, a speech that now has a viral life. Many of you know Philip from his 1995 best-selling book, The Death of Common Sense, which has just been reissued and which he will sign for you today. His latest book is Life Without Lawyers, Restoring Responsibility in America. Philip Howard.
Thanks, George. It's a pleasure to be back at the Commonwealth Club with a cheery topic, Is Democracy Killing Itself? Thank you all for coming. I actually think the message is at least modestly hopeful, because what I'd like to suggest today is that America doesn't have a permanent problem. It has a structural problem. And if it changes the operating system to replace this structure, there's no reason why we can't unleash the same wonderful American energies and instincts and can-do culture that our country is known for, but we're not going to be able to do that or make democracy work again, in my view, unless we make this change. Now, I probably don't have to convince you that government is broken. A couple of years ago, people didn't believe government was broken, I think. They believed that maybe we had bad political leaders, and if only the Republicans would win or if only the Democrats would win, that somehow the system would work better. Most Americans no longer believe that. Polls show that most Americans think this government is broken. And since you live in California, you know that government is broken, because California is obviously in the eye of this hurricane. Still, there's a tendency if only the parties would get together, if only they wouldn't be so polarized that maybe they could solve the deficit problem or make things happen. I'd like to suggest that the polarization and the deficit itself are actually just symptoms of this broader problem. And the problem, the flaw that I've identified, is that we've lost the capacity to make choices. The people supposedly in charge in government actually don't have the authority to make the choices to make anything work. It's illegal to make sensible choices. So much law and regulation is piled up over the decades, decade after decade, like sediment in the harbor. It's piled up to the point where no one can get anywhere, because we have this idea that everything, every choice has to be made by law. Now, if Congress and the state legislatures have the power to undo this law or to make it work more sensibly or more flexibly, but they don't even have the idea that they should do that. You don't hear any member of Congress, with one or two exceptions, talking about the need to do a spring cleaning of all this law so that we can meet current priorities. There's this cultural assumption that the public has gone along with as well, that law is permanent. We treat anything that's a law, that has the name law attached to it, whether it's an entitlement program or any sort of regulatory program, like it's the Ten Commandments, except now it's the 10 million commandments. And no one can even know it all, much less comply with it. This notion that law is permanent and it's all there for everyone's benefit is, I think, best exemplified in that comment by a member of the Tea Party last year, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." I mean, think about it. I mean, Medicare is a very important program, but it's obviously a government program. And so the question there is how it works. It's not whether or not government should do it or not. But everyone assumes that everything that there is supposed to be there, but it's not. And so what's happened with this law and the creation of law is that we're paralyzed. We're paralyzed at almost every level of government. So take the federal budget. In 2010, 70% of federal revenues were consumed by three entitlement programs that don't even come up for annual authorization by Congress. 70% of all the taxpayer revenues received in that year just go out the door to programs. They're very important programs, Medicaid, and Social Security, but no one's making a choice about whether the growth makes sense, whether the programs, every aspect of the programs makes sense. It's just on automatic pilot. State budgets have something similar. There's so many mandates, first from the federal government, and then from self-imposed laws by the state governments, that it's virtually impossible for the governors in the big states to balance the budget sensibly. When Andrew Cuomo got elected governor in the state of New York, he discovered that there was a juvenile detention facility that cost $50 million a year to operate where there were no juveniles being detained. So he said, well, I know how to save $50 million. We just close down that facility. Well, it turned out he couldn't do it. There was a state law that said in any state facility with union employees, there must be at least 1 year's notice before you can close down the facility. And so $50 million of taxpayer funds gets wasted in a facility that's helping no one because some law passed and got negotiated because the unions want it decades ago, and he couldn't do anything about it. Ministerial decisions, just the kinds of stuff needed to run government, say, to approve a wind farm or a power line, are almost impossible to do within the term of the elected office. Even the president doesn't have the power to do it. At one of his State of the Union speeches, he had this ringing statement that there's no reason why Europe or China should have the fastest trains. Well, yes, there is. Environmental review processes have evolved into a kind of a system of no pebble left unturned, and they literally go on for a decade or longer. He'll be long out of office before you could even get approval, much less put a shovel in the ground. I spent the afternoon recently with the project manager of the Bayonne Bridge in Newark Harbor, and it's very important to raise the roadway of this bridge by 60 feet so the post-Panamax ships can come in, which is enormously important for the economic vitality of the New York area and also environmentally important. You get more cargo with less fuel, et cetera. And they had figured out a way to raise the roadway within the existing historic arch without changing anything except raising the roadway. So they have this big arch. They're going to raise the roadway up within it. It's apparently structurally sound, and therefore keep the same foundations of the bridge, the same right-of-way on the roads, etc. They're 4 years into the project now, doing things like surveys of all buildings within a one-mile radius of each end of the bridge to see if it might affect some historic building, when they already know they're affecting no building. But the law requires them to go through processes that make no sense just because the law's written that way. It's completely absurd. It's a waste of time and money. It goes all the way down to the smallest incidents of life in society. This winter, a tree fell in a creek in Franklin Township, New Jersey, causing flooding. They were going to pull it out, but then they discovered that it was a Class C1 creek, whatever that means, and therefore there was a legal process. They went through the process, filled out the forms, got approvals, took 12 days and $25,000 to do what was completely obvious to everyone, which is to send a backhoe in and pull out the tree. Another example, also this winter in New Jersey, a church had a soup kitchen that had been going for 35 years. They served 200 meals a day, no problem. The way it worked is that the parishioners of the church came in, they would brought in food they made at home and served the people who need meals. Someone discovered there's a state law that requires that all food served in a public facility has to be inspected by the restaurant inspectors from the Department of Health, and they couldn't go inspect every kitchen, so they told them they had to close down the soup kitchen that's operated without incident for decades, or spend $150,000 building a kitchen and having a whole staff and making it on site where it could be inspected, which is what they're trying to do. But stories like that make you hate government. And if any of you have ever started a business, well, you couldn't start it today and comply with law. You couldn't possibly comply with law. In New York City, you have to get approvals from 9 agencies to start a restaurant. Nobody ever gets the approvals. You couldn't figure out what 9 agencies there are. You get the ones that are kind of obvious, and then you just ignore the rest. Well, it's not a legal system anymore. It's just a series of tripwires where people, and so does this stifle entrepreneurship? Sure. Because you know you're going to be violating the law no matter what you do. Because you can't rely on your common sense as to what the law is, because the law is not common sense. The law doesn't let you pull the tree out of the creek. So who's running democracy now? The answer is nobody's running democracy. Democracy is run by dead people. It's run by all the people who wrote all these laws and regulations over the decades. Some were well-meaning. Some were parts of backroom deals. And they just piled up decade after decade. And what they left behind was this huge legal blob. It's like some horrible organic growth that's kind of taken a life of its own. And there it is, all these rules and regulations. Nobody knows what they all are. You couldn't figure out what they are, but there they are, getting bigger and bigger every year. And when anybody wants to stop something or try to extort somebody into doing something, they just find some provision of the law that nobody can comply with. And then they come and put it in your face and say, you must do this or else you're violating the law. It's not the system our founders had in mind. We have a democratic structure that where it doesn't matter who we elect, basically. It's this huge, huge thing that's taken a life of its own. So what's the solution? The solution here is actually pretty simple in concept, is you put humans in charge again. Imagine that concept where you have a democracy where human beings could actually make choices. I mean, that's what democracy is supposed to be. You elect people, they take responsibility, they're bounded by law, they can't do anything they want, but they have room to actually make the choices needed to run a society, and their appointees do as well. In this world, law would be radically simplified. It wouldn't tell people how to do things. It wouldn't tell you how to remove a tree from a creek. It would basically say, you know, you have a responsibility to keep the creek in sort of environmentally sound or some such goal. If you're running a restaurant, you have to be clean and sanitary, and you give somebody the authority to go inspect it with some checks and balances. But you don't need books of regulations any more than we needed them 40 or 50 years ago when we didn't have them. All this grew out of the 1960s, this idea that law could be a kind of an instruction manual where it would tell everybody how to do everything and then life would be perfect. And, of course, it ends up being exactly the opposite. So in this world, you'd have officials with the power to pull a tree out of the creek. The president could approve a power line or a new bridge or whatever after a year of review, not a decade of review. You could actually move forward and he and his party could be accountable for whether we like the decision or not. Budgets. If we have legislation that results in budgets that we can't afford, the executive ought to have the authority to do across-the-board cuts so we balance the budget. Right? The law can't make people spend money that isn't there. That's not such a radical idea that the executive could do that. But no one even is talking about that idea. I mean, Jerry Brown would love that. Jerry Brown could make things work more effectively. Any governor could. He doesn't have the authority to do it. A business wants to get in business. How should government work? There should be an agency the person who wants to open the restaurant can go to, an agency that knows all the requirements. Then these are important requirements. You know, you don't want a restaurant pouring grease down the drains or such. You know, it messes up the water system. So, but people ought to go someplace where they can work with a government agency to do what's needed to do business in a crowded, interdependent world. We're not set up that way because government doesn't have the idea that it's actually supposed to help anybody. No one has the idea. It just has the idea it's supposed to go around giving tickets for noncompliance with all the rules that nobody knows what they are. So this new world is not a carte blanche. It doesn't let people do whatever they want. Law is a corral. You can have as many checks and balances as you want in it. We don't trust the teacher to be fair in dismissing a kid from the classroom. Great. Have somebody else you can complain to who can veto the decision. As long as decisions are based on human judgment, you can have as many checks and balances. You don't have to trust anybody as you want. The one thing you can't have is an instruction manual. Because when teachers are filling out forms all day, they're not teaching the kids. That's the difference. You move from a compliance bureaucratic model to an individual responsibility model. So how would you do that? I mean, how practically? Here we are, you know, we get surrounded by this huge blob that's growing every day and a whole class of people known as public employees who view their job as basically serving the blob, not serving us. So this is not the first time in history this has happened. One thing you do is you set up special commissions area by area. Hopefully not too partisan, like Simpson Bowles did for the budget, you know, come up with their budget ideas. You have a series of commissions, area by area, that come up with recommendations about practical ways of reorganizing each area of regulation. And based on a philosophy that law sets goals and has governing principles, but it doesn't tell people how to do things. Because life's too complicated to be run out of an instruction manual. You can't accomplish anything by following a rule. The Edison, this great line, hell, we ain't got no rules around here. We're trying to accomplish something. You know, and that's the idea that's needed. We probably need a constitutional change because what we've discovered in America is that there's this natural tendency, as one expert once said, for all programs to become immortal. As soon as a program is initiated, it has a special interest group that wants to keep it just the way it is. It becomes politically very hard to change it with that special interest group there. That's why farm subsidies from the New Deal continue to be in place some 80 years later. So we probably need a constitutional change that requires all programs with budgetary impact to sunset every 20 years. Doesn't mean they go away. If they're good programs, they get reenacted. but it forces the legislature to actually rethink priorities and talk about budgets. I'll give one example. Special education programs. 40 years ago, special ed, we ignored kids with special needs. We locked them up in horrible places like Willowbrook, and that led to the special education laws. So they're very important laws. But we wrote the laws as open-ended rights and mandates without any understanding of what would happen with them. So now, 40 years later, over 20% of the total K-12 budget in this country is spent on special ed. Most people think that number should be closer to 10%. That's a huge amount of money that's being taken away from gifted programs, pre-K education programs, lots of other programs that get nothing or virtually nothing, where over 20% is going to this one over-bureaucratized system where some kids get a Rolls Royce and other kids get nothing. It's not a fair way to run the system. So you would change it. You wouldn't get rid of special ed. You would just change it to balance the needs of other priorities. So we need a constitutional change. The third thing we need is we need to restore accountability to government. We have this idea that government is neutral, that we're not going to have the spoils system if we have a civil service where everything is laid out by rules and we have this permanent class of public servants who do the right thing. And there are really a lot of great public servants, and people devote their lives to making this work, notwithstanding the fact that they have to work inside this blob. However, public servants are supposed to work for the public. Some don't. They ought to be accountable when they don't. If we're going to give them the flexibility to use their judgment, somebody else has to have the flexibility to hold them accountable if they're mean-spirited or exercise their judgment badly. You can have checks and balances to make sure that decision isn't unfair either. You can have someone else oversee that decision, but you have to have public employees. You'll never have any system of responsibility unless the people who are responsible can be accountable. And today we have a system where more people go to the death chamber than get fired as public employees. A couple of years ago, the city of Los Angeles tried to get rid of 5 teachers. I think it cost over $10 million and took 5 years to get rid of these teachers. It's just a crazy system. So the next question, how politically could we do this? Nothing is politically feasible today, nothing. Congress can't even extend a budget deadline by a month. I mean, it's hopeless. The political system is literally, we see it every day. You see it today in California with this election. It's literally hopeless. But what the political scientists say is that we're going to get change, and that societies work by what they call punctuated equilibrium, that everything goes along one way and it looks like things will never change, and then there's this break. And the break occurs, and they call this the stick-slip phenomenon that occurs with earthquakes. Pressures build up and build up, and then all of a sudden, for events that you couldn't possibly anticipate, like the guy in Tunisia who sets himself on fire and sparks the Arab Spring, for example, the plates shift all of a sudden, and there's big change. That's happened in our country 3 times in the last century. It happened with the Progressive Era that got rid of this governing philosophy of laissez-faire, where you wouldn't regulate anything because the markets were perfect, and what we learned is that big corporations would mangle children and produce unsafe foods and such, and so we introduced, as we needed to, the idea of regulation. It happened in the New Deal with the idea of social safety nets, and it happened in the 1960s when the rights revolution, when we woke up to racial discrimination, gender discrimination, pollution, all kinds of bad values in our society that needed to change. We had a real shift in the frame of reference. That's what we need today. Except the shift isn't like those. The shift is about how we run government. It's restoring the idea of individual responsibility, where humans actually have the flexibility to do their jobs in government. It's abandoning a bureaucratic compliance model where we think government should be run by just complying with all the rules, which would be fine if there were 10 rules or something we could all comply with. But when there are 10 million of them, we can't. We don't know what they are. And we see the effects of all those rules, the paralysis every day. So we need this new system. It will happen only when there's a crisis. Not going to happen because we're all sitting here and talking about it and we convince somebody that it's a good idea. We've convinced a lot of people that it's a good idea, including Jerry Brown's very sympathetic to what we're doing. I've spoken with him about it. Leaders of both parties, people would love to see something like this happen, but there has to be a public demand for the shift. The powers, the inertial powers, are just too strong to have it occur on its own. So I fear we're going to have a crisis. But it looks like we're headed toward that. Trillion-dollar deficits are not sustainable. You know, the system just isn't working, whether it's in this state or on the federal level. And so what we're trying to do is create a new vision that's a responsible, practical vision about how to run a modern democracy. And if we get enough people behind this new vision and understanding how it would work as a practical matter, then when the crisis hits, perhaps, instead of getting something worse, we'll actually get a system that reflects the basic values of America. You know, what you all know is that real people, not rules, make things happen. Nothing you've ever done in your life, nothing you've ever accomplished, you accomplished because you followed the rules. You accomplished it because you woke up and you figured out a way to get it done. And it wouldn't have happened unless you figured out how to get it done. You know that's true. And it's true whether it's true in raising children, it's true in doing anything. Humans, individual humans, with spontaneous and instinct and guesses and taking risks, make things happen. We're never going to fix what's wrong with America unless we give back to humans the power to make those choices and get things done. And that requires a fundamental overhaul of our system of government. Thank you.
Online and radio audiences that were listening to Philip Howard speaking on Is Democracy Killing Itself at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and it's time for questions from the audience.
Very interesting. With nearly 200 countries in the world, which come closest to your ideal?
There are examples around the world where countries do parts of this better than others. But no country is this utopia of practicality. New Zealand had a spring cleaning of its legal system about two decades ago. It was very successful. And it really, spring cleanings traditionally are enormously beneficial for economic growth. When Justinian did a recodification of all the laws in the 5th century AD, it sparked an incredible commercial surge all across the ancient world. When Napoleon did a recodification of the civil law in the early 19th century, it provided the basis for industrial revolution in Western Europe. And all the Western European countries, except England, adopted this simplified civil code. So having simplified civil codes is enormously beneficial through history. When the U.S. created the Uniform Commercial Code in the 1950s, it created a solid foundation of understandable commercial law, which is the best commercial code of any country in the world still. This problem does not occur in contract law in the United States because some people got together and created a simplified commercial code. So there are lots of examples. Germany has a Ministry of Justice that refuses to let laws be too complex or duplicative. The federal government in our country has 82 separate programs for teacher training. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, nobody goes and cleans it up. So there are many examples. Saskatchewan has a very simplified basis for example, regulating restaurants and other things. So there are lots of examples you can look to in different parts of the world where people do things more sensibly. There's actually a great book written last year by an academic comparing the justice system in America with Germany and South Korea. And it did it by taking one lawsuit and showing how it would work in each of the three countries. I mean, it's hysterical. The other countries, you got fair justice within 6 months, it cost almost nothing. In our country, 3 years later, people were going bankrupt and they weren't even close to a decision. So there are examples of how other countries do things better, but all countries have variations on this problem of micro-regulation and such. And so this is a disease that, to varying degrees, is suffered by the post-industrial developed countries.
You haven't mentioned the media in this. From my vantage point, what I see is a commercial enterprise that is stymieing getting back to the old concept of objective journalism. Right. What we have today is that non-objective criteria where you have to give both sides of the argument, right. And I see that as a fear on the part of individual media outlets that they'll lose market share. And with some notable exceptions, what we have is, some say, journalism, and voters are left shaking their heads and saying a pox on both their houses. And the Tweedledee Tweedledum argument employed by Mr. Nader gave us W. So what do we do about the media? How do we attack that?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not sure I'd put the same tags that you do on what the media does. I think they believe they're being, quote, objective by letting sleazeballs present their case with the same seriousness as the people who are actually serious and responsible. I actually have a daughter who's a journalist. She writes for The Economist, and The Economist writes The Economist, I think, is, which I admire very much, writes with a point of view. And I think it's really important for everyone in society to go through their lives with a point of view. There's no such thing as not having a point of view. You might just be honest about it, come up with a hypothesis, here's my point of view about right and wrong and stuff. And my problem with journalists is they pretend not to have a point of view when they really do have a point of view. And from the standpoint of all of what we're talking about and the effort of myself and others to try to start a movement for a new practical form of government, you know, or kill the blob or whatever we're going to call it, is it the media actually won't talk about dysfunction and new ideas. They only talk about events. Well, yesterday, Representative so-and-so said so-and-so, and the president countered with such-and-such, as if that's news. Well, most of that's the opposite of news. It's just posturing. And, you know, I never made this point, but the reason politics, in my view, is so polarized and dysfunctional is because nobody has the authority to do anything real. If you talk to Bill Bradley or Al Simpson or the people in the Senate, you know, in the 1980s, they got together and made things happen because they believed they had the authority to do it. Today, for a confluence of a variety of reasons, politicians have given up thinking that there's something they can actually do. And so what do? They just yell and scream and posture and point fingers. It's your fault. No, it's your fault. And that's the game.
Reminds me of what's said about academic political infighting. Oh, the reason that it's so vicious is because they're arguing over nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we've evolved to a place where the what we call leaders, they're not leaders anymore, they're populace. And they're trying to please all the people all the time. And everybody knows that doesn't work. And I think that's where all your laws, like that mountain of plastic out in the ocean, come together. And you have a dead zone. Nothing happens. And the thing that you said about there are examples of a more refined leadership model. How do we bring those? Maybe we need to glean the information and bring representatives from those places into a public forum and explain to our quote-unquote leaders how to get this done.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I think there is an aspect of both learning about other countries and also embarrassing our leaders into doing things the other way. We have this new joint venture with the Atlantic Monthly that George mentioned. It's called America the Fixable. And each month we have a topic. This past month was on healthcare costs. Next month is on reconnecting justice to the goals of a free society. We've done one on school bureaucracy. And one of the things we try to do is get people from other countries to come in and write about how they do it differently. So it's at least one small effort in that direction.
Academia in our country is talking to academia. It's not talking to the masses. And this message, and that addresses the media, this message needs to get to the masses. We're crippled. These conversations at the Commonwealth Club daily, but as soon as the audience walks out of here, it goes into the round cycle, the round bin in their mind.
I know, but I'm going to sue you all if you do that. I'm going to have a lawsuit. I'm going to have I've got all your names and numbers. Don't think you can get away with that. Here, yes, ma'am.
There's one right over here.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you for your talk. I don't feel we, as the people of this country, have enough ability or power to bring about these needed changes, if you have any suggestions about that. And also, all the money that, to be wishful candidates to be, need to run a campaign to win, that seems very undemocratic. What do you say about that, or how can that be changed?
Well, I think both of those are really important points. First of all, we have to create public demand. So if you care about this or want to do, we have a not-for-profit, we have a mailing list, we have materials you can send on to your friends. There'll be more things to do, but just in one small way, if you're interested in helping, you can become part of the dialogue and get your friends to be part of this dialogue. So we have to create public demand for a new system. And we have some ideas about doing crowdsourcing for new solutions that we're talking with some of the leaders of the Silicon Valley about helping us do. So we have a variety of ideas. We're talking with some leaders of Congress from both parties about starting a new organization with Republicans and Democrats in office that would have a two-point platform. First point would be Simpson-Bowles, or responsible budget. And the second part would be sunset commissions, going back and cleaning up. That's it. Just two platforms. It's not partisan. It's just responsible. And those two ideas embody we have to live within our means, and we have to go and clean out the old law so that we can make new priorities. So there's some likelihood we're going to do that, and we'll get attention for that. But we need support. And ultimately, it does have to translate into political support. The campaign finance system in this country is incredibly self-destructive and expensive. And personally, I would be for public finance, even though that has problems, because it's just so ugly. And it's become so bought by special interests of all sorts. So that's another place where we need to make a clean shift, like a stick-stick phenomenon, and we just abandon this system and go to one where private parties don't give money.
I have taken a mantra in the problems like this. I'm a problem solver. And a lot of people talk about their rights. They'll talk about other people doing wrong to them. But I put another one. It's not just reading, writing, arithmetic. It's rights, wrongs, and remedies. Now, I want to suggest an approach to remedy in the idea of getting things right here. Not what's wrong and right, but what is it? How do we get it fixed? And I'm thinking one of the strategies we could use is to get the bench bar in conversation with the public about the state of the courts and the funding of the courts. The courts of the bench bar decision-making process that profits in making the law complex and long time. Some people are making a lot of money at this, but we're having a social disaster, and right. The courts are now coming to ask for money to run the courts their old way. But it's a time for us to come and say there need to be new ways, and we start with a conversation between the people and the bench bar. Now, down at, like, Herb's Theater, they have programs, and they'll say so-and-so in conversation with so-and-so and charge a lot of money. Let's propose that this people that make these in conversations with gets people a bench conversation between somebody that isn't part of the bench bar and the people, and start talking about how are we going to fix this way of not spending all our money on people in prison and then right. taking away from college. Now, if we we need conversations on this, and let's use our individual one. We don't have to form especially a new organization, but we have to use our creativity and a little bit of initiative to propose at places we might have a conversation.
Right. I agree that the courts have serious problems. It's amazing because American courts are by and large impartial. They're not corrupt, and yet the system isn't working at all. We're incarcerating, you know, half of black youth between certain ages, usually for trivial crimes. It just turns them into hardened criminals. We let anybody sue for anything. So as a result, people are so scared of accidents that we don't have seesaws or jungle gyms or diving boards or all those things have gone extinct. Doctors practice defensive medicine because they don't trust the system of justice because it's not reliable, in fact. So we do have problems with the courts. That's the subject of our month's discussion on the Atlantic just starting this week. I don't agree that the solution is to get the bench and the bar together to discuss it. I have a lot of conversations with the bench and the bar. They have no interest in this discussion. They think things work just fine. They're deeply offended if you say the courts don't work well. You have to embarrass them into making the change. You have to build a popular movement where it becomes aware, just as the civil rights movement did. The civil rights movement, Brown versus Board of Education, didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of people asserting a moral wrong. Well, we have to get together and assert a moral wrong with sort of sue for anything justice and a criminal system that criminalizes everything. And so I'm afraid that the solution here is not, by and large, discussions. The solution is a movement.
I have two questions. The first is, you started by talking about, and I don't remember the phrase you used, but certain types of laws should have sunset clauses. Would that be all laws or only a particular type? I'm thinking about what many people think, that the repeal of Glass-Steagall led to much of the crisis. So I'd like some information about that. And the second is, does your group do anything about a discussion or a understanding of how we can have a discussion about what is the appropriate size of the military for this country and how we can get those funds under control?
The second one, we're not involved in the military, and we're not involved in any foreign policy issues. The responsible way to deal with sunsets, in my view, is to appoint commissions which will then recommend the changes, so not to have everything automatically expire. If there were an automatic program, it should be for things with budgetary impact. You don't want the law against murder to sunset. You know, the law against murder is perfectly, you know, reasonable law. But it isn't a bad idea to reconsider laws and programs that are very important. I gave the example of special ed. We don't want to get rid of special education laws, but it doesn't work as intended. So it ought to be reconsidered, not to get rid of it, but so the people elected today to be in charge can make those choices. And I think this is an important conceptual point. Americans are very distrustful of any change because things are working so badly, so it's natural that everyone's distrustful. But the system we have is a democracy. And while you want some stability in law, you don't want entrenchment in law. Laws become most of the laws that we're talking about are not they're not basic principles, they're not the Constitution, they're not the basic criminal, you know, laws against criminal behavior. They're basically social management tools. Let's subsidize farmers because they need to be subsidized. Well, guess what? The crisis ended in 1941. So why are we still spending billions of dollars for some rich corporate cotton farmers? You know, it makes no sense whatsoever. So I don't think it's a bad discipline to take the risk, if you will, of reconsidering even good laws so that we can, you know, so the people we elect can make choices. Again, why should the people who are dead be making those choices? We're electing people today to run our society.
I think it's just a great combination between reviewing the laws and also saying, well, these got started for good reasons and they're good laws. They've just gone overboard. I mean, if you take something like Social Security when it was started, people didn't live, you know, as long as they did, and so it was affordable. But you have to keep figuring it out as time goes on.
I was thinking about Social Security, too. And in the case of Social Security, we have an actual date at which point it will no longer be able to pay the benefits. I mean, right. there's a date there, and it may change along the way. But and the solution, as it's been expressed to me, is that, well, we could cut back slightly on the benefits. We could increase the retirement age, or any number of small ameliorative steps that would prevent or at least push this crisis decades away from us. And yet, we seem to be unable to do anything at all with Social Security. And I've heard this expressed that one political party believes it's socialism and, in fact, wants the system to fall apart so they can replace it with something completely different. In fact, one political party wants this crisis, this gigantic shift brought on by a crisis, and therefore will do nothing to ameliorate anything that prevents the onrush of this catastrophe. So if that is true, then what you're trying is doomed to failure. I agree with so much of what you said, but I don't see that you have a ghost of a chance to accomplish it. I'm sorry.
I think I said at the beginning or at some point, I don't think that I or we have the power to do any of this. But we're going to have a crisis because the current system is unsustainable. There will be change. Really smart people, political scientists, cynics, believe there's going to be big change. So the question is, are we prepared for it? Can we help move and advance towards an area? The progressives, who finally overcame the philosophy of laissez-faire, had worked on it for two decades. They had built up, it was led by leading citizens who got together in discussions like this and said, what should it look like? How does a fair society work? You know, how would you regulate it without destroying the essential energy of a market economy? They had all those discussions. And then there eventually became a scandal or two. In that case, Upton Sinclair wrote a book, and it pushed everybody over the edge, and they made the change. So history would say that you are completely incorrect
that we will not get change. History says, read Polybius, read any of the greats, we're going to have change. The only question is when and what it is. And so the cynics, you know, I don't think people, to me the cynicism of the political system is not that they're trying to get failure. They're just trying to beat the other side. Washington has become a deviant subculture. I think Sacramento has as well. It's taken a life of its own. Everyone has their own framework. All they want to do is beat the other side. They won't actually get together because it's not even in their idea to get together. They won't consider old laws because it's not their idea to get rid of old laws. I had this fantasy once that what we could do was pass a constitutional amendment to move the national capital. It wouldn't matter where. You know, we can move it to Elko, Nevada. It doesn't matter. We can move it someplace unattractive. You know, move the national. And the advantage of moving the national capital is no one could move with it because they wouldn't be able to sell their homes. So you have this new place where new people, without all of this deviant subculture stuff, they spent a lifetime in pointed hats writing all these rules that tell you how to do everything and when you can pull a tree out of a Class C1 creek and stuff like that. You know, they're not there anymore. You have a whole new practical group of people. The crisis will give us some sort of opportunity like that. The lady in yellow has been holding her hand up for a long time. I'm prejudiced against yellow, but I think you should be able to ask a question.
What's your guess about the type of crisis that would come about what do you guess would be the crisis for the change in streamlining our legal system and making things simpler and being able to do these things you're talking about?
The answer is I don't know. My suspicion is that it will be a crisis arising out of too much debt. People won't buy the bonds anymore. You know, the government won't be able to finance itself. We're going to have to rebuild. There will be some government version of what happened a couple of years ago on Wall Street. There's going to be some kind of liquidity crisis or some other thing where even the power of the printing press doesn't allow the Weimar Republic. I mean, you know, there'd be some crisis related to the unsustainability of what we're spending.
Excuse me. I was a little taken back by one of your earlier remarks because it applied to me in my thinking when you suggested that, many of us think that it is going to be an election or a situation that allows one or the other side to at least be in a dominant position rather than a standoff, which we have right now. And then you made the comment about the three crises, which I thought was very provocative. I've been thinking about those. And the characteristics, two of the characteristics of those three crises, it seems to me, were that the public didn't really vote for the agenda that came in afterwards. In fact, if we had had a California-type democracy where it had to go to a referendum, I don't think that the changes of the progressives, right, the New Deal, or the civil rights movement would have, in fact, come into place. Right. Ultimately, it was there. Each case, it was a political group who was dominant for a period of time, had enough sufficient power to put something in, and who chose an agenda which was not necessarily widely supported in the public. So it seems to me that this idea that we have to get at least one side or the other where there's enough power at one particular point to act. Now, I thought that was going to happen in 2008, but it was so short-lived, only 2 years. So do you have any further comments on this and why you reject this idea?
Well, I think there is the examples you give were examples where you had one strong parties. You had Sam Rayburn in the House and Lyndon Johnson as president doing the Civil War. And you had the it was in the aftermath of the assassination of JFK. There were many there are many characteristics that made it possible to create the civil rights laws, and Robert Caro is brilliantly, you know, describing these. When George Bush had both houses of Congress and was in the White House, the agenda of the Republican Party was payback time. It wasn't make change. It wasn't do good. It was payback time. They really did not do it. And I don't remember whether Clinton ever had both houses. I think he did for a period. And I work with them on the Reinventing Government Initiative back in the mid-90s and such. But they didn't accomplish a lot either. The New Deal had a real crisis. I mean, a crisis of starvation. That was a powerful driver of change. The civil rights movement had a powerful moral basis plus fear that was driving, that provided a powerful impetus, even though I agree that probably a popular referendum would not have passed it. Nonetheless, people understood both morally and to a certain extent, fear-wise, why perhaps it made sense to make these changes. So you didn't have a great revolt except in Arkansas and Mississippi and a few places like that. We're going to have a crisis, but whether we move back to, away from a bureaucratic model, I continue to believe, will require us to create our own movement. We're going to have to create a vision for America that's attractive to Americans. It doesn't have to be to all Americans. We don't have to have, you know, we don't have to have whatever it is, 160 million people sign on to our program. But we do have to create something that's concrete enough and real enough and that people can understand so that it's available as an option. Because today, and just to close, today you can't run a democracy if you can't make choices. We have to create a new structure that allows choices to be made at every level of responsibility.
So is that why in 2008 then, it fulfills all the criteria you've given? Crisis, dominance of one party,
right.
Irrational leader. Why didn't that happen? Is that what you're saying?
First of all, there was no new vision.
Now that it can't happen?
Secondly, that was a crisis. That was a crisis in one industry that threatened to ripple through all other industries, but it was really not a crisis of the livelihood of most Americans and such, so I don't think it was a crisis on the level that I think will be required. Number one, and number two, nobody back then or even now, except for us, is talking about a new vision of governance. The whole idea that government is broken. That government itself is broken is a new idea. I led this. People accept it now. They didn't accept it 2 years ago. It's new. I've been at this a long time. It's only in the last couple of years, giving TED talks and other stuff, that I realized that people actually now are saying, "Oh yeah, you're right. You know, this system really is broken. It doesn't matter who we elect," which is not completely true, but to a great extent true. We have to change the system. This is a new understanding by the public, and we need to take advantage of that understanding and create a new vision. And if you're interested in helping, I hope you'll sign up, tell your friends, and think about what you can do and communicate with us. Thank you again for coming.
Thanks, Phil, for that great talk. It's the political equivalent of in technology, like in alternative energy, where there's all kinds of technologies waiting for the price point to hit, and people don't realize that the solutions are out there. But if you don't have that developed, it's not going to be able to be used. So thank you very much. And this ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 109th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.